This is Art Unbound, the official podcast for the Portland Art Museum and Northwest Film Center. My name is DJ Ambush, and I'm the operations and content manager at 96.7 The Numbers FM, a community-based radio station here in Portland with the focus on representing Black music and culture. Back in the fall of 2019, we partnered with the Portland Art Museum for their exhibition, Hank Willis Thomas, All Things Being Equal. We set up live broadcasts in the galleries and knew right away that this was a solid partnership. When the pandemic hit last March, the Numbers in the Art Museum applied for a grant together from the Regional Arts and Culture Council. And thanks to the funding provided by that grant, we were able to work together again, pooling our resources. This episode you're about to hear is a result of our partnership coming to life in the Portland Art Museum galleries. I sat down to interview and completely nerd out with Portland-based cultural phenom, Kenny Fresh, who runs a record label called Fresh Selects. Links to everything Kenny and I talk about can be found in this episode's description, as well as at portlandartmuseum.org/podcast, where you can also find a full episode transcript. How are you today, sir?
I'm good. Today, I'm good.
Okay.
It's been crazy year to say the least, but yeah, today I'm good.
Yeah,
right. It's just part of our reality now,
right?
So today I'm good.
Okay. So before I ask how any of this has affected what it is that you do, tell the people what it is that you do.
Yeah. So that question used to be hard for me to answer because I had years while I was still figuring it out, but now it's very concrete. I run a record label.
Nice.
I own and run a record label. I put out records. I put out music. All of this craziness going on really hasn't affected. I've been very fortunate. It hasn't affected what I do specifically and personally all that much, at least compared to, you know, someone like yourself who's more of a, or, you know, doing live DJ events. And, you know, my business, my label, Fresh Selects, was never very event oriented, or our artists aren't dependent on touring, or, you know, some labels, especially like rock labels, will not put out an album unless the artist can tour around it, because that's just part of, you know, their campaign, their model.
Right.
I've always been not an internet label, but my music, my relationship with music, a lot of it has been through online. So, you know, a lot of that hasn't changed for me.
So explain that, because just, you know, the traditional record label model, touring would be your responsibility. You know, some of the more outward facing things in stores, things that are directly being affected by COVID will be your responsibility. What's the model that you're operating under where that doesn't directly affect your bottom line?
Yeah, so Fresh Selects started as a music blog back in 2008. And at first I was just kind of reporting on artists that had, you know, it was kind of the era where it's before streaming, it's kind of the iTunes era where people would put out like the first single for free, or they put out a mixtape for free in hopes that you would buy the album on iTunes.
Yes.
So a lot of my posts at the time were just like, here's the free single from so-and-so, or here's the free mixtape. And then linking to it. And then as I kind of started to get an audience, and I knew some artists already, I would get like exclusives where they would let me premiere the single or premiere the mixtape.
Okay.
And then I started to create original, you know, mixtapes with artists, or kind of help an artist finish a project, or connect them to a designer if they needed artwork for it, or things like that. So the label grew from that. So just like then I would just release something for free on the website. Now I'm releasing it on Spotify and, you know, Apple Music and iTunes and all these things, and Bandcamp. And a lot of the audience that I've built up is through, you know, online music fans. So, you know, we press physical copies, not always, but, you know, our kind of, you know, vinyl is really expensive. So our artists or our projects that kind of warrant it, or a lot of times we'll put out an album and then the response will be so good that I'm like, okay, we could do vinyl and we won't, you know, lose $3,000 on it. So
it, with regard to physicals, are you also doing cassettes?
Yeah, I started doing cassettes because that's all I could afford. I started the label just, you know, on a credit card. And really, I always wanted to start a label, but I just didn't think I could. It just seemed like something you needed to, you know, be born with money or sell drugs to make money. Like, that's most of the record labels, you know, like Raucous Records came from, you know, a kid whose dad was like the CEO of Fox News.
Right.
And then you have like Death Row, where they got their money however they got their money. Right. And that's how they you know, so there's always like one or two ways to start a label. And I didn't have, neither of those were the route for me or an option for me. So I just didn't think, you know, it just seemed like a pipe dream. But then when Bandcamp came around, I started to realize that it's actually really affordable to start a label and to put out physical releases. And I had friends who were putting out cassettes just that they would dub themselves. And then I looked into the cost of actually manufacturing cassettes, and it was only a few hundred dollars. So I was like, okay, I could put that much on a credit card and, you know, get it started. So that's really when it clicked for me. And when I started the label, was the second I realized that I could. Yeah. So a lot of the label is mostly a digital presence.
Okay.
We don't have an office. We don't have an event series, you know. It's really like, it's an online thing for the most part.
Of all the platforms, mm-hmm. you named a couple just now, and I know from a consumer standpoint, I mess with Tidal heavy because they give the biggest payout to artists. From a consulting standpoint, do you have a preference?
I personally use both Spotify and Apple Music. Spotify, I think, is best for discovery. Mm. Their playlists are really crucial for that. And that has become a big part of releasing music, is trying to get on those playlists mm-hmm. and doing everything you can to put yourself in a position where you're likely to get chosen for those. Apple Music is solid. It's just easier for a lot of people to use on their phone. So it's kind of access. But Apple Music, for the most part, I feel like people are listening to stuff that they already know.
Yeah.
Or Spotify, I think they're finding out a lot of new music. And that's really been an exciting change. And it's been really interesting seeing the effect that Spotify has had on music and how it's released, both in good and bad ways. Mm-hmm. 'Cause there's a lot of people, especially like lo-fi hip hop or like beat tapes, those playlists do really well, but it's a lot of passive listening where people just put it on and they're doing homework or whatever.
Yeah.
So there's artists.
Beats to study too.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a few artists from here in Portland that have songs that have millions of plays, and they have very little fans or name recognition, you know, but there's good money in that.
Yeah.
But you know, they can't really play shows or put out an album necessarily under mm-hmm. their name. It's just kind of, if they're not on those playlists, they're not really connecting. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, one of the downsides of it, but there's a lot of benefits to it too. As far as the most advantageous for the label, and if I could choose one platform to make it bigger and make it the norm, it would definitely be Bandcamp.
Okay.
Because Bandcamp by far offers the best split. They're not a streaming site. They're more so for buying a download, mm-hmm. But also for physical copies. But Tidal is definitely the best for streaming, but their audience is just so small. And it's just not the same, you know? If everyone was on Tidal, that'd be great.
Story.
You know, my label would make more money. But if everyone was buying through Bandcamp, I'd be living great, you know? But it's important to be well-versed in all of them, you know? So I don't really prioritize one over the other too much. Mm-hmm. But Spotify and Bandcamp are kind of like the main focus for the most part.
And I'm glad that Bandcamp is experiencing the resurgence that it is right now.
Definitely.
I remember when it first started, it was like, I don't know what they're doing over there.
Yeah.
It just seemed like another place I had to have an account for.
Totally.
To make sure people could find music.
And it was kind of amateurish. It was kind of like a lot of, you know, like back in the days, it would be like SoundClick or like certain websites when someone would send me a link to, I'm like,
yeah,
okay,
yeah, I'm not listening
really,
there.
Like Reverb Nation, you yeah. know, I'm like, okay, this isn't really,
yeah.
you're not really aware of what works and what doesn't work.
Right.
But I think Bandcamp, they were able to shake that pretty quickly. And then to me, it's kind of crazy that like bigger artists don't use it, you know, like for
right.
people who do, because a lot of people do still buy music on iTunes. They'll like buy the MP3s, not as much as 5-10 years ago,
right.
still a decent amount. And if they were getting those sales through Bandcamp, they'd be making good yeah. money.
Even
you know?
The subscriptions, just yeah. subscriptions on Bandcamp. Uh-huh. I love the ability to support an artist
yeah.
by just, you know, buying a monthly subscription and I'm not thinking about it.
Exactly.
$5, $7, whatever yeah. they're charging me. Cool. It's just coming out each month.
Uh-huh.
Not even thinking about it. I love yeah. the ability to do that. And then to be able to engage even further. And when I feel like it, buying whatever, you know, songs, singles, albums from different artists that I don't yeah. have subscriptions for. Like, yeah, definitely having a much better relationship with Bandcamp the second time around.
Yeah, and it's the best way to directly support an artist. Like, if you were to buy a release on my label right now, I'd get an email that would tell me your email address and tell me, you know, if you bought certain songs, which songs you bought.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, and then I receive the money within 24 hours.
Dope.
Spotify, it's like 3 to 4 months before you get paid. There's no real way to know exactly like, oh, I got 100,000 plays on this song. You can only kind of estimate what that actually pays out to. And then by the time you get it in 3 or 4 months, you kind of, that number is no longer what it says.
Yeah.
It's just, so it's always just kind of smoke and mirrors and yeah. you're just kind of like, whatever comes is whatever you got paid
whatever
for.
They say, whatever
Band
they say.
Bandcamp, it's like, you know, if you bought it for $10, Bandcamp's like, we're going to take $1, PayPal takes $1 and here's your $8. And
it's that simple.
That simple.
Yeah.
So if everyone was buying it that way, I'd be making, you know, I'd be making 80%, 80 cents on the dollar.
Yeah.
Whereas Spotify, you know, is like everyone knows, you know, fractions of a penny.
Yeah.
And even iTunes, I think, is like maybe 60, 70%, you know, out of a download.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's a vast difference.
Spotify is holding on to that data. They are not.
Yeah. That's the thing is Spotify is, they're a tech company and they're a data company.
Yeah.
And music is kind of a thing that, a method, you know, Bandcamp is a music company.
Yes.
Spotify is a tech company that deals in music. And especially now where they're putting a lot of their budget towards podcasting, you know, they're mm-hmm. not really, which I'm not against, but it just kind of shows where their focus is and what their bottom line is.
Oh yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
If something crazy were to happen and music would just to become unpopular, they would just, you know, go full podcast
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah.
Or Bandcamp would just be like, all right, we're not a company anymore.
Yeah.
You know, like it's so that you could tell the difference in intent, you know.
Let's talk about some of the artists you've worked with.
Mm-hmm.
Better yet, what was the first artist relationship that you had that you were like, okay, so this is what it means to operate in this space. And yeah, this works for me.
So the first artist relationship I had was I was working for an artist, Wajid. He's from Detroit.
Okay.
He's part of a group, Platinum Pied Pipers.
Yep.
And he had a label called Bling 47 where he put out his own releases and he also put out some of the earliest instrumental releases from Jay Dilla, who was like, still is like my all time mm-hmm. favorite, you know? So that was huge. I mean, I was a huge fan of Wajid's. So we got in touch through online. They reached out to me and offered me an internship, just working remotely. I was living in my mom's basement, you know, and doing it. And they were in Brooklyn at the time. So he was, you know, kind of my mentor. And him being a producer, he was really collaborative and worked with a lot of artists. So I would kind of meet the different singers and rappers.
Okay.
And, he was a DJ as well, so other DJs. And he was just really well-respected. And, you know, it's one of those people that, like, if you knew him, it was kind of like an inner thing. So it's like, oh, you know about Wajid? Like, it kind of
yeah.
is a certain kind of
yeah.
status or knowledge of independent music, you know? So that was really a big... you know, step into music. And that was when I was 17. So that was huge for me. And so through him, I met a lot of artists. And that's why when I started Fresh Selects as a blog, one of my earliest posts was an unreleased Platinum Pied Piper's PPP song with J Dilla. It was like a year or two after he had passed, when, you know, there's no more J Dilla verses in existence.
It's not happening.
This is one of the last ones that he recorded and wasn't released. So that, like, that was probably, you know, week two of having a website. So that was like big news and got us some traction early on. So then through the website, I met a bunch of artists, like Devin, who was a producer from here. And then he was in a group with Knowledge, who's since gone on to be really big and has produced for Kendrick Lamar and Action Bronson and all these people. And then in that same group was the artist Mind Design.
Yep.
And so Mind Design was one of those people I was talking about earlier who was putting out his own releases on cassette on Bandcamp. And I was buying them, and he would only press like 25, 50 copies. They would sell out in like a day. And so, you know, I think I was able to get one, and they put out a second one and I missed it. I was like, damn, man, these are selling fast. That's when I started looking into how much it cost to manufacture. And I'm like, oh, we could, you know, make like 300 tapes for like $500 or maybe a little bit more. I was like, oh, I could, like, I don't, you know, I was dead broke at the time, but I was like, I could put that on a credit card, you know, and then I only need to sell this many to make it back. Like,
and
okay.
Then you were shipping them out yourself.
Yeah. So, so Mind Design was the first artist that, it was the first release on the label and was the first artist that was kind of like, it just seemed like a good fit because he already had an audience. They were already like rabidly supporting him, but he didn't really have structure, and he didn't really have plans for his releases. He would finish it, put it up same day, and just send a tweet and be like, you know, new. And it was working for him, but he had never really been on any blogs. And I think at the time hadn't really had any music on.
So what year was this?
2013. Okay. So he signs the Stone's Throw, like, I think the year after, maybe 2 years later. So he was like right kind of on a peak or a pinnacle moment. And I knew that about him. And him and Knowledge were always super tight. And Knowledge had just signed a Stone's Throw.
Okay.
And had just put out a cassette with them. So I was like, okay, Mind. And I thought Stone's Throw was kind of sleeping on Mind Design. I was like, that's crazy. They didn't sign him. Like, well, if they're not going to, then I'm going to.
Right.
And it turns out they were just kind of like waiting. And they were, you know, they came to him maybe a year later.
Okay.
But yeah, so it was a good moment. And I had my own audience from the website. And, you know, I kept the same name and everything. So it wasn't like so much a new venture as it was an evolution. Mm. Yeah. So our first, I remember my goal, we made 300 cassettes and I was like, it'd be really dope if we could sell out of all of these in the first month. And we, like, day 30, we sold, you know, the last five.
What was the strategy into accomplishing that?
Yeah, it was really just social media push. Okay. And he had also created, he had a mix series called Frugal Earth, and it was kind of just like blends, like he just kind of loops and blends and pretty, you know, I don't know, it's kind of a pretty loose collage kind of DJ mix.
Okay.
He put out one on SoundCloud and did really well. And then he was making another one while we were working on the album. He was like, yeah, I'm going to put out volume two and I'm going to put it on cassette. And I was like, oh man, that's going to like I was hoping to be your next release.
Right.
And I was like, well, how much money do you think you'll make off of that? And he told me, and I was like, all right, I'm going to pay you that amount of money. And then can we include this mix as a free bonus item when you buy the album on Bandcamp? And so that's what we did. So, he had actually ended up putting out the album. We were working on an album, and then he put out this one called Breatharian. He, like, super quick, he was like, hey man, I need to like make my rent money for this month. I'm going to put out, this is just a collection of beats called Breatharian. I'm going to put it out. And I was like, all right, like I can't say no. Like, yeah, you need rent. Money. Like, yeah. So I'm like, all right, do it. And then he put it out. And then I heard it and I was like, damn, I kind of like this better than the album we were working on. So our release together actually turned out to be a reissue of that album because he didn't do cassettes. It was digital only. So I was like, all right, how about we put that on cassettes? Give me two bonus tracks. And then he was doing the DJ mix. I was like, all right, that'll be a bonus item.
Right.
So it was all this for like $10, you know?
That's dope.
And we made a music video for one of the songs, which he had never had a video at the time. But yeah, it was mostly just a social push. Like, we didn't do an in-store. We didn't do a release party. Those were all things that, because I was working remotely, he was in, He's from Philly, but at the time he was already in LA. But I just didn't have the money to fly out there and or like set up a venue. I just didn't really have all the connects. So we just kind of did it how we could, you know, very grassroots and DIY.
That's why I asked you what year that was, because we interviewed him on Voltage Radio. I think we had a show called, I can't remember the name of the show. Me and Illustrator Mars 5, we had a show out there in Philly, and Mars was telling me, he was like, yo, these dudes are nice. Yeah. Like, production-wise, they're nice. And like, I never heard of them. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And then when I was in there for the session, I was like, oh, no, this is crazy. They're both mad humble and chill. Mm-hmm. And a lot of producers are like that. You know what I'm saying? But it's something to just watch them just like zone out in a discussion about the creative process.
Yeah.
And then you hear it and this is like, but no, I heard you explain it. But yeah. No, but still, how'd you get here?
Yeah, this is crazy. Yeah.
This is wild.
And they were really, or I mean, it was that kind of post-Dilla.
Yeah.
Not post-Madlib, because Madlib is still relevant to this day, but just like after Dilla passed, there was kind of this next movement.
Yeah.
And I feel like they, and Flying Lotus and other producers were going one way with it. And that was cool. I liked some of that stuff, but I wasn't 100% on board as much as a lot of my peers were. But the knowledge of mind is on the direction they were taking it was just something I related more to.
It was a little more grittier. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. It was a little bit more vibier and less kind of where I think like I felt a little bit more jazz and soul in it and less electronic, you know?
Is that where you lean more towards as far as the artists that you work with on your label?
Yeah, just my personal taste. I really love all music. So I look for artists who kind of exist on the boundaries or on the edges or the intersections of different genres, you know? Like I put out all different types of music. So I've put out jazz music, but it's jazz music by people who listen to hip hop.
Got you.
And then we'll put out the jazz album and then we'll have hip hop producers remix it from stems. And I've put out rock bands, but they use samplers and they listen to, you know, knowledge and stuff like that too. So I really like the intersections of things. And a lot of that is influenced by, you know, really kind of some of the pivotal music I was listening to in high school, where people like Dilla, Questlove, D'Angelo, that whole Soulquarians movement.
Yeah.
So all the music, so I was super into them, but I've always been very nerdy about music. So it was never just enough to be into the artists I liked. I always wanted to go into the artists that they liked. So, you know, D'Angelo would talk about Marvin Gaye, or they would, you know, have a song that mentioned Fela Kuti. So I would get into that, or they sampled Herbie Hancock. So I would listen to that, you know? So a lot of my music exploration and context and, you know, knowledge has come from artists like that and artists from that era. So now the music I put out is kind of reflections of that. There's kind of different seeds, and a lot of the music I put out can be very eclectic, and some people might only like some of the stuff I put out,
which is great.
Is how I prefer it, because I've never really wanted to be a one lane label, because I've just never been that type of listener.
Right.
You know, I might get into moods where I'm only listening to old Wu-Tang from, you know, the early years for this week. But then the next week I'm listening to, you know, Miles Davis all week. And then, you know, I just go into zones. But I think I would get really bored if I was just a hip hop label or just a beat label or any one thing, you know. It might be smarter business wise, but it's just not.
I think
who
old
I am.
Model. I think old world, sure, smarter. Yeah. I think it's smarter, especially with that larger label mindset.
Right.
Especially when you're talking about the way that they choose to do marketing. Mm-hmm. You know, I think in that
you're
way,
just talking to the same audience every time.
And then, you know, they lock in and they got that formula and they're being lazy about it and boom, 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 you're getting the same thing.
Yeah.
My first experience with dealing with a label that wasn't afraid to stretch those boundaries was definitely Stone's Throw.
Yeah.
And I was so used to what they were putting out from a hip hop and just beat standpoint that when they released Chin Chin's album, I was like, no, but what is this?
But that was a Def Jux. Was it but Def they were Jux? The same thing. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Especially Def Jux. It they were Def only Jux. Like Aesop Rock, Cannibal Rocks, LP.
Right.
And then there's like this funk Brooklyn band. Yeah.
Yo,
but I really like that Chin Chin
that
album.
That Chin Chin album was crazy.
Yeah, it was really dope.
So when it dropped, so I'm working at the record store at the time and we're getting all the promos. So you're right. We were definitely getting on the Def Jux stuff.
Yeah.
And I was like, the artwork looked really, really dope. So I just took it home.
Had the bright lettering, the yellow background.
So then like it sat in the crib for a couple of months. And I was like, all right, I'm gonna do some cleaning. Let me just see what this Chin Chin stuff is. Blew my mind immediately. And I was like, why is this on Def Jux? What's happening? Like, you know, it's crazy. Yeah. So it's a really solid model. I think it's smart. I think it's really smart.
And I think like Def Jux, they had spent so many years being a hip hop label that release was kind of a departure for them.
Like super backpack.
And Stone's Throw kind of went the same way. For like their first few years, it was like only, it was Loot Pack and then Madlib Solo. And then the guys who were featured on Loot Pack, it was very, like it was a crew for the most part.
Yeah.
And I don't think it was until maybe Madlib makes Quasimodo where it's like, oh, this is a weird thing. And then he makes Yesterday's New Quintet, but it was still like Madlib. It was through one artist, but they ended up, and then they would do like the funky 16 Corners, like reissue stuff. But so growing up, being a fan of labels like both of them and kind of studying the game, I was like, okay, I want to establish my base, but I want to do it quicker, and I don't want to be a rap label that pivots. I want to be an eclectic label from day one.
So in an effort to establish that model from day one, did you have like a quota or like a sheet or a list? You're like, I want this type of artist this week. I want to shop and find this type of artist next week. I want to fill this box.
Not so much as outreach. I've never come from a place of like, oh, I need to get a jazz artist. Let me find one. But I would consider those things in a process of elimination.
Okay.
Where if a rap project would come to me, like, but I just put out three rap projects, then maybe I would pass on it unless I really, really, you know, spoke to me. But it happened pretty organically. And at first, actually, my idea for the label was to be a reissue label for things that were only available digitally. I was going to put them on cassette and give them kind of a proper treatment, you know, like one of my favorite or just an idea that really inspired me because I'm big into film and in movies. The Criterion Collection, just how they're like, you know, they'll restore movies from the 60s or international movies that never really had distribution in the US, you know, like a Godard, you know, movie from France, or, you know, all these famous directors from Japan and all stuff like that, or stuff that never really got its due or since been forgotten. Then they always have incredible design and packaging, and they also just have a brand. So I might even have never heard of the director or the movie, or might be a subject that doesn't really interest me. But if it's Criterion, it's probably worthwhile.
Exactly.
You should at least give it a chance.
Exactly.
So that was always my goal. I wanted Fresh Selects to be like that brand that you're like, I don't even really listen to jazz music, but it's Fresh Selects. I've never, you know, steered me wrong before. So that was my idea. And again, it was kind of I've always had pretty realistic goals. I just didn't think I had enough money to like put out original projects. But I'm like, if you've already made it, I can make it better and give it like some physicality and put it on cassette.
Gotcha.
So that's like, so Mind Designs project was that. And the second project we put out was this artist Lowleaf, who in her by herself is eclectic. She's a singer, she makes beats, she plays the harp. So it's like Alice Coltrane meets MIA meets Georgia Ann Muldrow. It's just like she's five genres by herself. So if she was the only artist I put out, I'd be a multi-genre label. So that really appealed to me. But I was talking to her and she actually came, it was her idea. She was like, you know, I think premiered a music video for her on the site, and you know, that worked well. And so she was like, yeah, I'm working on an album. And I think she was actually living with Mind Design at the time. They were roommates with a few other artists. And she was like, yeah, his name is Ringo. She was like, yeah, I really, you know, I saw what you did with Ringo's album. I really like that. Like, would you be down to put out my album? And I was like, oh yeah. Like, why didn't I think of that? Like, oh, I could just put out an album. It doesn't, she doesn't need to put it out first and then I re-put it out. Like, it was just like, yeah, I can just put it out. So my second release was Low Leaf. And so that already, like, Mind is on a Low Leaf, even though they're friends, they live together, still is just very eclectic between the two of them. Mm-hmm. And then my next release after that was a pretty like traditional R&B soul kind of throwback record, this artist, Coltrane. So from the beginning, and there's a clear through line.
Yeah.
Like, you could play those three artists on the same radio show, but not if it's a hip hop station or a jazz station, you know? But if it's like what you guys do, or just, and so that's always interesting to me, because I always wanted to be in the elevated spaces. Like I was saying about Wajid, not everyone knows him, but if you know him, you're like, oh yeah. Like, and if you know Wajid, that means you know Detroit techno music. You probably know some Dilla stuff. You probably know Beat CD stuff. And it kind of like is just kind of a, I don't know, it's a certain barometer or kind of a bar to clear. And so if this music could be played in the same place, it's going to be a really cool place.
Exactly.
You're not going to hear it at just some corny club or, you know, so, and I've always, not to be too pretentious or elitist about it, but just naturally just pushing boundaries and kind of eliminating some of those unnecessary parameters of what, you know, how things are formatted.
It's a good place to be. It's a great intention to have with wanting to curate people's experience and deliver music in that way. Like, I think about it, I compared it to, you know, the DJ experience when, you know, people come to the booth and they're like, yo, can you play this? Can you play this? Can you play that? And I'm like, these are literally songs that you have memorized because you hear them all day on the radio.
Right.
Or you play them all day.
You probably listen to that song on your way here.
Exactly.
Why do you need to hear it right
Why
now?
Why do you want me to play this again?
Yeah, yeah.
So you can listen to this song that you have memorized in a room full of people that have probably heard it a billion times too. Like, we're not here for that. Let's not do that.
There's something to that though. Especially now, there's certain songs that come out like, man, I wish I could like be out when this song is playing.
Definitely,
you know, there
now
is a communal experience, but it is funny when people request the number one song out right now, and a lot of times it's like, I'm gonna play that, but it's 9:30. I'm not playing it now.
No.
Like, that's gonna be like 11:30 midnight, like peak of the night, you know. But I do think, kind of circling back to some of our conversation earlier, I do think Spotify and the streaming era has done a lot to also blur those lines of genres a bit. And I think
in a good way.
Yeah, in a great way.
Agreed.
I think digital, just the music going digital, and really I look at it as music is free now. When I was in high school, I had to not eat lunch so I could use my lunch money to buy a CD that would be like $17.99 if it wasn't, you know, new and on sale.
Yeah.
You know, at Best Buy or the record store. And so I was really picky about what I was buying, and I would, you know, try to listen to it online, or I'd dig through at record stores and try to find, I had a list of albums in my mind that I was looking for, and I was waiting to find them used, you know, 'cause you can get a used CD for like $8. But so like music discovery was expensive and it took time. Now, like,
it's an algorithm.
I really started to first notice it with Tyler, the Creator, when he first came out. It was probably, what, like 2011, 2012, around there, when Odd Future and all that.
Uh-huh.
But when he would, you know, talk about his influences on Twitter, it's like, oh, you could tell he was like listening to MF Doom on YouTube. And then the next thing that came up was like Cortex, because, you know, he got sampled by him. And then from there, he hears about the Italian, you know, film score group Goblin and all this really obscure stuff. And these are like $100 records if you were to, you know, because they're long out of print and stuff.
Right.
But I'm like, oh, he's just listening to him on YouTube. Like, and his taste was so eclectic, and he became so iconic and such a cult figure for people of his age and younger that it's really influenced his fans have pretty eclectic taste, you know, and they'll listen to, you know, a Mac DeMarco next to Earl Sweatshirt, next to Solange or whatever, you know, which is really cool. Because even, you know, I was in high school. I mean, damn, it has been, you know, 20 years, I guess. But still, to an old man like me, it doesn't seem like that long ago. But I would kind of, you know, some of my friends would kind of make fun of me for listening to Erykah Badu or D'Angelo. It was kind of seen as being like feminine or mm-hmm. just, you know, they were like hip hop heads. They only right. wanted to listen to Mos Def and,
right.
and Talib Kweli and, you know, these things. And I listened to all that stuff too, but I don't know. I was just like, this music just spoke to me in a different way and for a different mood. And I was always into female artists, more, you know, more sad music, love songs, all types of stuff, not just like rapping about rapping and, yeah. and battling, you know?
Yeah.
But I feel like, you know, younger generations, it's just natural. I think more kids than not are listening to different genres and yeah. different types of songs and not just... I mean,
it's about
just,
accessibility, right?
Yeah.
What we were growing up listening to was dictated to a greater degree either by the radio or the amount of money you had to spend totally. On releases yourself,
mm-hmm.
period. Like you said, at this point, music is free.
Yeah.
So if you have a subscription service, you can listen to anything.
If you're on YouTube...
Right.
Yeah, I probably heard the name Herbie Hancock for 5 years before I got a chance to listen to an album.
Right.
Today, I could, you know.
Five seconds.
Yeah, just takes a quick search.
Yep.
There's still a lot of people who still won't branch out, but I could just see the difference. Like those gaps are smaller than ever, you know.
Because so much music is at our fingertips, do you find it challenging being a label right now?
Totally. That's the kind of the double-edged sword of it is that it's easier to access music than ever. It's easier to make and release music than ever, which mm-hmm. is a great thing, but also an overwhelming thing. Like I have a playlist that I update every week called Tight Songs. That's what I started as my radio show on X-Ray. I did it for like 2 or 3 years on X-Ray, and then I was just taking away too much time from the label. So I started just making a playlist on Spotify and Apple Music. And it, you know, it's all new music that came out in the last few weeks or a few months. And it's just kind of this curated thing. And it's really a way for me to, gives me a reason and a method and a format to sort through all the music that's coming out, because there's just so much.
So
and
much.
Who has the time? Like there's probably 6 hours worth of music that I like that came out yesterday,
man. You know,
on Friday. And so if I don't go through that, there's going to be another 6-10 hours of music that came out, you yep. know, this Friday. And I'm putting out an hour of music that, you know, that came right. out on this album on a Friday too. So it's hard to get people's attention. And so, you know, I could put out a release that people really like, but oh yeah, that's really good. I like it. And then meanwhile, there's 5 other things that came out that they like too.
Yeah.
So, and I get paid every time they listen to it.
Right.
Where in the iTunes or physical model, if they like it enough to pay $15, $20 for it, you made $15, $20. And if they never listen to it again, you still got your $20 out of them. But now, right. if they only listen to it once, you got maybe a penny if they listen to the whole album, you know? And if they never go back to it, even if they really loved it that one time, you got a penny from them.
Yeah.
So, you know, so I do a lot to try to extend the life of music. We'll do slower rollouts. Lately, what I've been doing, like I put out a remix project. Well, remixes are one thing too, where it's the album came out, so that album is done. I have nothing else to put out from it. But then what I could do, and especially to kind of bridge some of the gaps, because I'm aware that it could be a big ask for certain members of my audience mm-hmm. to listen to this album, it might be a bit far from what they're used to. And so I could take that and have artists that I know they like and have them do a remix of it and kind of bring it into
gotcha.
That world. But
gotcha.
Then putting out the remix is something that gives me post-album content to kind of extend the life of that. But we put out a jazz album that had, I think, 7 or 8 songs on it. And we got each song remixed by 2 different producers. So we got kind of a 16, kind of call it a double album. But in the digital age, what does a double album even mean, you know? But so I have this 16-track album. I really stand by all 16 of them. I'm really strict about the track list. Like, you know, we probably had a few remixes that came back that were just cool, but they weren't good enough to make it on the, you know, final album. Right. But so I have these 16 tracks and I'm like, even if we put out three singles, it's still 13 songs to ask for someone to listen to. So what I did is I split it up. I was always treating the album like a double album anyways. Hmm. So I took side B and put that out as an EP first. So that was like 7 or 8 songs. And then we put out another single from side A, and then we put out the full thing where it has all 16 together. And I think that made it a lot easier for people to have the time to listen to it. It's not a big ask for you. You know, the 6 song record was maybe 15, 20 minutes long. You know, that's not too much to ask. And then
the good thing about that album is the play is 15, 20 minutes long. It's over before people realize it, and then they run it right back.
Exactly. That's always, like, replayability is something I always focus on and strive for. And that's why, you know, a lot of labels, especially labels that are used to the CD vinyl era and of having to acclimate to streaming, they really don't like streaming. Mm. Me, I've never really had that privilege. I started when streaming was already kind of the norm. So streaming has been good for me because what I've found is that if a record connects with people, they seem to listen to it constantly.
Oh, yeah.
And like I said, I get paid every time they listen to it. So like there's multiple albums where even if they would have bought it for $20, I probably made more than the $20 if they would have just bought the vinyl.
Gotcha.
Then because they've listened to it for 5 years now.
Yeah.
You know, and I get paid every month, or even if it's just one song that they put on their playlist and they just listen to it constantly. So that's what I've seen is that, you know, before it used to be all about first week numbers and stuff like that. And it still is for people who more so go off of Billboard charts, which I, you know, never have. But our releases, they don't really have like a dive. They kind of
plateau.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. They plateau and they stay consistent for years. Like my most successful records still pay out pretty close to what they did in their first month or two. That's to this huge. Day. And it's been 5 years.
That's huge.
And there's no sign of that. You know, it might wane a few percent every year, but that, you know, that's a couple dollars. It's pretty negligible difference.
That definitely says something about quality of the music. That says something about the release strategy.
Yeah.
Like you said, that I like that phrase, like, you know, the slow rollout.
Yeah.
You know, where you're so used to hearing the exact opposite of it. Yeah. You know, the rush, got to get the slow rollout, extending the release of the project.
Mm-hmm.
A great example of an album that will always be in rotation for me is D'Angelo's Black Messiah.
Yeah.
I may take that break, but then there's I'm cooking right now. I need to have it on. Like, those mood setting projects. Absolutely. And then, like you mentioned, the Soul Aquarians earlier. That's a whole vibe. That's a whole mood. That's a whole universe of music between all of those artists that put you in a certain place that are like, this is the mood I need to be in right now.
Yeah. And that's another theory I have is there's two different types of releases that I'm interested in, or artists that especially appeal to me. Is there's artists who kind of own a zone, and you could put it, D'Angelo Voodoo is one vibe throughout. You put it on when you're in that zone. Maybe you've got a partner over, maybe you're cooking, but it's that zone.
Yeah.
Sade is, they own a zone. But then there's others, maybe like Slum Village Fantastic Volume 2.
Woo.
It's one of my favorite albums, but there's all different types of vibes, you know? There's cool laid back vibes, but there's also Raise It Up, and there's, you know? And so Fantastic Volume 2 is kind of universal in that if I, you know, there's breakup songs, there's love songs, there's hype songs, there's chill songs. So there's a song from there for every mood I'm in.
Yeah.
So it's kind of constantly room for it in my life, but also I can put it on and listen to it from beginning to end and it doesn't feel like a compilation or it's on shuffle. So those two types of projects are what really appeal to me, where it's like, this is a chill jazz album and there's nothing in, you could sleep to it because there's no one sharp song that's going to wake you up because it kills the vibe, or you could have someone over and you're talking and there's not like this one moment where there's really harsh, you know, trombone solo that you can't talk over anymore. So I look for really consistent things or things that are really eclectic. But and then for those, we try to be mindful and try to make them cohesive in their randomness. And that's what Soulquarians were so good about,
yeah,
where they would have, you know, little interludes in between that would bridge. If they're going from a slow song to a fast song, they would have a little beat in between,
yes,
that kind of starts,
yes,
off slow and then goes
brings
fast,
it up,
which,
yep,
as a DJ, you know, is what it's all about. So
yep,
I really try to program or sequence my albums, you know, with the releases on my label. I'm super hands-on with there's certain parts of creating records that I won't get involved with. I don't tell artists what type of songs to make or what to write about, or I'll never be like, you should change this line, or I don't get into the weeds with that stuff.
But you know where it belongs.
I'm like, finish the song or get the song to a place you feel like it's finished. Then I might get feedback like, oh, you should extend the outro, or like, that's so short, I wish there was a bridge, or
right,
something like that. Something more big picture with it. And then when the songs are done, then I'm like, here's my vision for where these all fit together. Then I send it to them. They'll usually, sometimes they'll be into it, sometimes they'll send it back, and we'll kind of, you know, keep chipping away at it from there. But sequencing is one of my favorite things. And when I was doing the radio show, now that I do the playlist, I kind of treat those the same way.
Okay.
Treat them all like a DJ mix, or like how an editor would, you know, how you would edit a film.
Right.
It has, you know, a beginning and an ending and a middle and some sort of, doesn't need to be a narrative of this happens and then this guy does this. But there is like, I don't know, like even some of my favorite artists, some of my favorite songs don't have my favorite albums, because it'll go from sad song to happy song to sad song with no real,
yeah,
connection in between.
Yeah.
And it'll be fast, slow, and it's like,
what?
But if it goes from sad to slightly optimistic and then gets happy and then,
yeah,
there's a turn and then it gets sad again, that makes sense, and I,
yeah,
could sit with it, you know?
Yeah.
So that's something I always try to keep in mind when I have those eclectic projects that have these different types of songs. You try to find some through line. Maybe it is narrative, maybe it is vibe or BPM or whatever, but and that all plays into the replayability, which has now become more important than ever.
Oh yeah.
Because if it's just this one, like, you know, people used to be able to make millions of dollars off a one hit wonder because people would have to buy the $17.99 CD to get the one song.
Yeah.
Now they can just get the one song. So, you know, you're going to make 1/10 of what you would off of one song as if you would have 10 songs that are strong. So, I look for albums more so than I do singles.
The first actual record I purchased, the first vinyl record I purchased, was 93 Till Infinity.
Wow.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that was
when it was
my,
new? Was it like when it had it just come out?
Yeah. When I bought it in 93,
as
it dropped.
That's dope.
So like, that was it for me. So when something like Handsome Boy Modeling School came around, it was like all of the other, not necessarily like weird, but all the other genres of music that,
yeah,
I was engaging with as a kid and even in high school, you know, listening. Like I said, my homie introduced me to Metallica and a bunch of other,
right,
stuff. Like, oh, wow. So
it's a full circle moment.
It came full circle.
Yeah.
It came full. It was beautiful. It was like, damn, this is so dope.
Yeah.
And it's still hip hop.
Yeah.
Yeah. Handsome Boy Modeling School.
Yeah.
They like helped solidify the weird for me. When
yeah,
that album dropped, it was like, no, wait a minute. How was all of this happening? Like Prince Paul and Dan Automator, crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
Paul is just wild for the night be. Like skit originator as far as I'm concerned when it comes to hip hop.
Yeah.
Like, so like when I heard that joint, I'm like, how is this happening right now?
Yeah.
Why aren't more people listening to this? This is insane. Deltron 3030. This is insane.
That was another one for a lot of people where, so I think for me, I think this is one of my favorite things about people who are into eclectic music,
mm-hmm,
is the different ways that people can arrive at that same destination. Because for me, my earliest experiences with music largely came from my father, who was super, he had a big music collection. He had an entire room in our house that was called the music room. Wall to wall, like library shelves of CDs mostly. He had some records and tapes, but he was a big CD guy. And but he was really into like the Beatles, Rolling Stones, and kind of Bob Dylan, that kind of like 60s dad rock kind of stuff. But he did have the kind of standout essentials. He had Stevie Wonder songs in the Key of Life, John Coltrane, Giant Steps, stuff like that. So those were the kind of the ones I would gravitate towards. But you know, you saying Hands Up, you, I'm assuming maybe you might have come from more of a rap music standpoint than Handsome Boy Modeling School is when things get weird. Me, I kind of came from weird music and kind of nerdy things and then got into hip hop more in like middle school, late elementary school for me. So then when Dilla or Quasimodo or something like that would get into these weirder, more psychedelic things, it kind of resonated and reminded, it kind of connected me to my father in a way. So it's for like, me, this is this weird Frank Zappa stuff that he would listen to.
So for me, it was kind of the same experience. So my father's Nigerian, my mother's Jamaican, you know, I'm first generation. So a lot of the things that I grew up listening to, like, so my fiance would be like, you know, so what was your relationship with Stevie Wonder coming up? Like, it wasn't the same as yours. You know what I'm saying? Like, a lot of the American soul music that African Americans grew up listening to wasn't my experience coming up. I was hearing what my parents were experiencing, what their American music experience was. So it was anything from, of course, my dad playing Fela because he's from Nigeria.
Yeah, yeah.
My mom playing, you know, Peter Tosh. At the same time, I'm hearing Fleetwood Mac. I'm hearing Peter Frampton. I'm hearing all of that.
Gotcha.
The Police, like, this is what I'm growing up listening to. Yeah. So as I began my own musical journey, and of course it's starting with golden era hip hop, you know, just for me, as far as what I'm.
That's the type of stuff that, like I was saying, that I strive for, is that stuff that can kind of connect other genres and doesn't have to necessarily, doesn't have to be like a rap rock thing, you know? Like a full, like a, doesn't have to be two genres. Nah, it's not really the vibe I'm going for. But like you know, a jazz musician who's playing a jazz record, but you could just tell through his timing that he's, you know, listening to unquantized Dilla drums.
Yeah.
You know, like that subtle through line between different genres is really what appeals to me the most.
Give me your 5-year. Everything goes right. Everything continues to go on the trajectory that you want it to be.
Yeah.
5 years from now, what is the label doing?
That's a good question. So right now we are in year 7 of the label. Man, that's a hard question. I'm not very long term. I wish I was more. I really take it day by day, and now I've been trying to get better at it. So now I'm going more year by year. I have a pretty decent idea of what next year is going to look like for us, which I never could have said at September of any previous year. But 5 years from now, I don't know. It'd be great to, I would love to expand to other things, just like how with the label, I never wanted it to just be, it would have been easy to just be a beat tape label.
Of course.
It would have been easy to just be an R&B label. I never wanted to be just one of those things. And so, but I wanted to establish those things so we had a home base, and then we could branch out from that, but then always return to it when we needed to.
Okay.
And, you know, so in that same regard, I have always thought it would be nice long term to do. I've never done any t-shirts, or I've always just been music. Got I've never you. Even made a sticker. Like, I've just been so, because I know a lot of people who'll start a label and the first thing they do is make stickers.
All the merch.
And make t-shirts. And they haven't even put out a release yet.
Right.
So I'm like, you're a t-shirt company. You're not a record labels put out records, you know? So I've always like put out records. Like, I put out albums. That's what I do.
Right.
And then one artist was like, oh, you know, I have this shirt design. I was like, okay. So we made one shirt that was attached attached to one album.
Right.
That's it. So it's probably long overdue. But also, I never wanted to make a t-shirt unless people wanted it. And now I think we've had, for long enough, people have been asking me for shirts. So I'm like, all right, we should probably make some shirts.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah.
But I will make some like logo t-shirts.
Okay.
But it'd be dope just to put out just shirts too that aren't necessarily like, maybe Fresh Selects is just the name of the line, but it's not branded all over it. It could just be a shirt. And in that same way, I'm also really into art, and I've been heavily getting back into comic books. So I would love to, I don't really know how that intersects yet, but it's something I kind of keep in my, you know, peripherals, and just kind of this floating idea. And then I'm looking for that connecting dot, but I would love to publish at the very least zines, if not graphic novels or something. So I'd really like to expand in that way.
Would you want to deal with film at all?
Film too. Film is another thing though, where it's, I've dabbled in directing music videos before, which was really fun. But film is just one of those things that just seems so expensive. And so, you know, it takes, even to make a short film, it could take 50 people and a few, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to do it right. So that's something that maybe for the 10-year plan. but like, you know, putting out a comic book or a graphic novel, like, that's, you know, just knowing the right people and having a, you know, a few thousand dollars, if you know, if that. Same with shirts. So I'd like to just do more different stuff. I'll always be putting out music, and the music will always be what it's been. It'll be eclectic and consistent and cohesive, and albums you could listen to from front to back. But when I think of long-term plans, I don't really, because like I said, I've never really come from a place of like, I need to put out a jazz release, I need to put out a rock band, or so I don't really think of like, what type of artist will I put out in 5 years? That's just kind of on auto, but like whatever comes to me, the best of what I come across that wants to work with me, that's what I'll be putting out. And that's always what I've put out.
I like that. I like the idea of, you know, diversifying what the products are.
Yeah.
And, you know, venturing into apparel and comics and things like that. But I think what really would really make me a champion of you doing this is the approach that you've laid out. Like, it's got to be organic.
Yeah.
You're not jumping to do any of it. If it's the right thing.
Yeah, I don't want it to be a gimmick.
Yeah. You know? It's not like, it's not part of the marketing attached to the product.
I'm not going
to
commission Ibrahim to make a comic book of one of my artists.
Exactly.
You know, like,
it's just
I would just want it to be completely separate. We just keep it under the same name. And that's kind of what Fresh Lex has always been. It started as a music blog. Then I threw a concert series here in town. We had a spot. Sponsors. We were able to get some really great artists. We had Madlib, we had Erykah Badu, we had Jay Davey and Blue and all types of people. That was dope. And then it was a record label, then it was a radio show and a record label, now it's a playlist. And so I've always just kept it open-ended where I could make it whatever I wanted it to be. But sometimes I get so tunnel focused and so hung up on the details of the five albums I'm working on right now that I forget that I could do anything.
Yeah.
And instead I just keep doing the same thing. So it takes conversations like this to remind me that like, oh, right. There's still other things that I need to get to, you know, but it's hard. And eventually at some point I got to get better at getting more people involved, because it's always just
it's still a
me.
One-man show for the most part.
Yeah. One of my closest friends, Tafiq Mardini, he's been super crucial in me scaling to the point that I have, because he does pretty much 100% of my designs and artwork and animations for Instagram and video clips. So if anything, it's me and him. But as far as like signing artists and working on the albums and working with the artists, like Tafiq works with me, I work with the artists.
Okay.
So it's pretty much a one-man operation, and then the artwork is a separate one-man operation that, you know, I kind of consult and collaborate and annoy him with, you know, feedback. But yeah, so it's really always just been me. And so having a staff just seems like inviting people into something that's always been so personal and so such a passion project.
Is there a fear in that? Because I'm interested to know why that wouldn't be part of the 5-year plan.
Yeah, it should be, right?
Right.
But I think it's more, I guess fear would be a way to put it, but I don't know, just my nature. I'm not the most social person, and I'm a bit of a shut-in, and that's largely how my relationship with music kind of came about, and how it's always sustained, you know? So it's just been me in a bedroom on a computer receiving music. Now it's me putting out music through that same method.
Yeah.
So I get emails once a week at least of college students asking to volunteering to intern. And I'm like, yeah, I just don't know what I would have you do. Like, my day to day is writing emails and listening to artists, listening to albums, giving feedback, maybe getting on the phone. Like, I don't really know what of those steps they could do.
Right.
I used to ship things out myself, and that took up so much time. But now I have a shipping partner that does all our fulfillment.
Okay.
So that was kind of the one kind of physical in-person thing. But I've got that covered, and that's been going great. So it's like, I don't really know what, and something Taufik and I, because he's done design for other record labels, like indie rock labels in New York. And so he's always a great kind of barometer for telling me what's more normal and what other labels do. So he's kind of like, you got to get a staff at some point. I'm like, yeah,
what
do they do? And what do I pay them? And because my payment is all commission off of how well stuff does. So I'm like, I have to pay them a salary. Based on what and how much is enough? And can I afford that? I've never paid that.
Right.
You know, I'm barely like, just in the last year or so, I've kind of gotten to a place where it's like, all right, the back catalog is earning so steadily that now I know for sure my rent is going to be covered next month. And unless something changes, I'm good for the covered for the bare minimum, which is a great brand new feeling for me.
Right.
For the first, you know, I said I'm in year 7. The first 4 or 5 years, that was not the case.
Yeah.
It was very check to check, month to month, you know.
Yeah.
But so I'm like, I just got me good. Now I got to pay for someone. Like, I got to be someone else's full-time job. Like, I don't really know what that looks like. Or I don't know. So will be in the cards at some point. I just don't know how or what. But if I want to do these other things, I'm going to need some help with, you know, the day-to-day for sure.
Yeah. Delegation is tough.
Yeah.
Delegation is tough.
Strong suit.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a muscle I'm learning to flex and build up.
Yeah.
It's tough. You know, you get used to wearing so many hats and being so familiar with the operation as you're learning the different changes in the industry and, you know, you're making adjustments. So you couldn't really imagine still being in the phase of understanding that you have and having to impart any of that on someone else and then give them direction on top of that.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm responsible to.
Yeah. It's just a foreign idea to me. And so much of the label is just so personal to me. And, you know, I didn't write any of these albums, but they all mean so much to me and they really have to do with my personal taste. And, you know, that's really what I look for in an artist, is an artist that sees things similar to, or like they see the same thing in the album that I do, and that we're eye to eye on it. And, you know, there have been times I've worked with an artist and then we get halfway in a project and we realize like, oh, we want this album to be different things. At that point, I'm like, well, you're definitely right, because it's your album. So,
exactly.
But that's not the album I want to put out. So like, we should go our separate ways and you should put that out. Like, and I'll probably still listen to it as a fan, but I can't put it out under this thing that I'm doing, because this thing I'm doing is like my vision for music, you know? So that's a tough thing to navigate, and no one really wants to hear that news, you know? But so collaboration has always been kind of a tightrope for me, because I know exactly what I like and what I don't like, and I'm understanding about that, and I know it's subjective. I don't treat it like fact, but it's still what it is for me, and I'm not really too interested in compromising that
That's really important. Having a label and curating the sound of that label is a huge responsibility.
Yeah.
You know, so it's very important that you have that relationship with the entire process and with the artists that you're working with.
When I talk to people ask me about starting a label or, you know, what to do or what it takes, there's different types. There's people who are just good business people, and they just, they're good with schedules and they're great with working with people. And those, I wish I was more like that. And if I were to hire someone, it would be someone like that. So they can kind of fill in that blank for me. For me, I come more from a place of just discernment and like a lot of quote unquote taste or whatever that means to you. That, you know, I hate the term tastemaker and all this kind of stuff, but really what it is just discerning. It's just like, I like this guy is rapping and is good, but it's not good enough for what I'm trying to do.
Right.
Or he's rapping good enough and over the beat is fine, but it's those things, to, you know, oh, there's just so many things. And it's just a matter of having standards, having context for those standards.
Yeah.
And then if you know how to take something that's below them and raise it to the point where they meet or exceed those standards, that's when you're really cooking with fire.
Right.
But that takes, you know, years of experience. But discernment is really like the biggest part of my job. And I think if there was a talent that I have, that would be it for the large part.
For people hearing this interview and they're interested in working with you, what would be the best way to approach you? What ducks would you suggest that they have in a row? And how would what would be the right approach? Is like, is there a day of the week that you listen to music? You know what I'm saying? Like,
as an artist?
Yes, an artist. That, no one's running up with demo tapes anymore. How's that? What's the best way to get?
It's tough because I get hit up by artists. You know, I get hit up offers for internships maybe once a week. Mm-hmm. Probably 7 times a week I get, you know, hit up by artists sending submissions. And I try to listen to everything. Sometimes you could tell just from the email, this isn't one I need to listen to. But then when I do listen, that's where the discernment kicks in. Sometimes in a few seconds, I'm like, this isn't it, or this isn't for me. Sometimes I listen to a project, oh, this is really dope, this isn't for me, but I'll recommend it to another friend who has a label.
Right.
Or I'll be like, oh, this is really cool, but it's not, this album isn't for me, but I think they're dope. So I'll be like, hey, I'm working on a remix project right now. Do you want to remix something I put out? You know, so there's different ways for me to work with artists. But the way to get my attention, and this is my advice to all artists when they ask this type of question, is to make something great.
Boom.
Make a great album, you know? A lot of people, like we were talking about earlier, it's easier than ever to make music. It's easier ever to
absolutely
make. But just because it's easy to make doesn't mean you don't hit me up with the first 5 songs you ever made and say, hey, I want to put out this 5-song EP. It's like, why? Like, what? Even if I were to sign this, I can't, it being on my label doesn't magically make it good.
Right.
I can only put out good music for it to do well, you know? I can't, so like those songs being those songs and now they're on my label, it might get more people to listen to it and give it a chance because of the label's brand or past releases, but it's not, but people are still going to hear those 5 songs as they are. They're going to, they're not good. So they're it's not going to convince people that they're good because it's on my label. So it's like, so that's the biggest thing an artist, and that's hard, is being able to judge your own work.
Oh yeah.
You know, like that's probably the hardest thing. So I get it. And I don't make music. I have zero musical talent. So, you know, I don't mean to be dismissive of people who are chasing that, because if they can make a bad song, they already can do more than I can. I couldn't even make a bad one. So I don't at all mean to be dismissive of people's hopes and dreams or whatever. But the best thing you could do to get attention from a label is just already be great. Just really take it seriously. Really make a song that, and step back and be able to listen to that song and be like, if I heard this, I would be excited by it.
Gotcha.
And I would be interested in who this artist is. Maybe it's because it doesn't sound like anyone else, but it sounds enough like different things that are recognizable, or, you know, whatever it is, but just really take it seriously. Like I get sent a lot of music that I'm just like, you, and not all music that's made quickly or without professional means. Like a lot of times that makes stuff more interesting. So it's not necessarily that. It's not that you don't have the right equipment or the sound quality, but it's just the care and the intention of or just attention to detail. So if you send me an amazing song, I'm going to be interested 100% of the time. Doesn't matter if you send it to me through Instagram or through email or through band, like it, the method doesn't really matter.
Just it's give
the,
it
it's
to
the
you
song. It's sure the music. It's
yeah.
So focus on the music, you know, 100% of your energy. And then when you're completely depleted, write a quick message and send it to me. You know, like don't, some people will, you know, spend an hour making a song and a month sending it to people, you know, spend a month on the song and you could send it to people for an hour and it'll go farther, you know?
Exactly.
So that might be a bit obvious and not the most helpful, but it's the truth. It's just make something amazing. And if you send it to five people, you might have five people, you know, fighting for you. And then, you know, that's when you're really in a good place.
So if people wanted to check out Fresh Selects, where would they go?
Bandcamp is probably the best place because it just has our whole catalog. So freshselects.bandcamp.com. Also, if you follow me on any of the social media, then every Friday I put out the Tight Songs playlist. Usually the most recent release on the label will be like the first song on the playlist.
Okay.
So you could check that way. You'll hear the latest thing we've put out, but also just what I'm listening to and other artists that I work with or just am a fan of. So I think that always gives a good context to the label because the label is not only about what I put out, but also just what I'm a fan of, you know? It's at Fresh Selects on Twitter, at Fresh Selects label, all one word on Instagram, freshselects.bandcamp.com, soundcloud.com/freshselects. Really, that's it.
I'm thumbing through the Bandcamp right now and the artwork. And yeah, the artwork alone.
Yes, Tafik.
The artwork and then like just the roster of artists. Like this already feels like home. It already feels like,
I'm glad
man, I'm slipping. I should have been over here.
That's the thing
already.
I try not to be too overbearing with the branding. Fresh Selects isn't a collective. It's not even necessarily a brand. It's a collection of music. So if you've heard of Mind Design, if you've heard of Sir, if you've heard of Emma V, then I've done my job. It doesn't matter that you didn't realize they were all on Fresh Selects and they're on these labels. That doesn't really matter to me so much. It'd be great if everyone knew Fresh Selects and everyone was like, this is my favorite record label. But a lot of people don't even have favorite record labels. They just have favorite artists.
Yeah.
So if I put out some of your favorite artists or just artists you're excited about, that's amazing for me, you know? So, you know, we don't put our logo on the album covers or, you know, try to be all up in the video.
You ain't trying to somebody all up in your video.
I'm not doing ad libs on all the tracks.
But you just said something that, wow, people don't have their favorite. They don't have a favorite label. There was a time, though, when it was very easy, like, no. I like Bad Boy.
I like Rockefeller. Def Jam. I like Rough Riders.
I like Raucous.
Yeah.
I like Motown. Like, you had a favorite label.
Yeah.
I think, again, just thumbing through the Bandcamp, looking at that, like, I really appreciate the intent of the artists you've collected, the work you've collected to give people through your label. Like, just looking, it's just like, it doesn't feel like it's all over the place. But at the same time, it doesn't feel like it's all the same.
Right.
So it's like, these are all the things that actually belong together. And there's these little branches that come off that go in different directions, but they still all belong right here.
Yeah.
Man, thank you so much.
Thank you, man. Thank you so much. What you just said is what I've always wanted to do. So that feels like a success. So I appreciate that. And you saying that is music to my ears. No pun intended.
Thank you for listening to Art Unbound. Be sure to visit freshselects.bandcamp.com to see Kenny's full roster of artists and their albums released by Fresh Selects. You can also hear tracks from Kenny's label by listening to us at thenumbers.fm or 96.7 on your FM dial here in Portland. I'd like to thank Kenny Fresh for sitting down with me this episode, the Regional Arts and Culture Council for providing funds to make this possible, and I'd also like to thank you, the listener.